Hello and welcome to the Too Much Time on Our Hands podcast slash stream. We are here to talk about one of Tom's favourite subjects this week, but we'll get into that in a second. I'm going to introduce you to all the wonderful, wonderful people that will be providing you the entertainment for the next hour slash hour and a half, or however long we decide to waffle on for. We have Russ. Russ, how's it going?
What's up? I was just distracted by Duncan apparently starting to disrobe as soon as he started doing the intro.
Well, that's
luckily,
always
slash teasingly, he seems to have stopped for now.
That's always for the best. Yes. Duncan, managed to keep your clothes on for once. It's always good. How are you doing?
We can only see like down to his
All
shoulders.
right. It's January, so there are germs everywhere.
Oh my
And
God, it's
I have a
crazy.
slight cold. It's horrible. But anyway, I am all right. How are you, Dan?
Not too bad. Not too bad, sir. I guess the question we're all asking is, are you shirt cocking it right now?
Going full on Winnie the Pooh. Okay. Literally
No?
watched that a few times.
You okay there, Duncan?
I dignify you with a response.
You not? No? Okay, cool.
No. Sorry. I've missed cultural references a lot today.
It's
I've
very
been very
cold
slow.
He's in Scotland. He's
Are you naked from the waist down is what I'm asking.
No, I'm fully dressed. It is cold. It is like -5 outside.
I do appreciate that you had a little check before answering, though. Well, it might be. No, I'm not.
At the moment, I can't remember. Yesterday, the other day, I was wearing long johns, so you know, I would have looked
Who's
like
John?
sexy pixie man.
I was
We all
wearing
know
long
John.
john like a glove.
And we have Tom, evidently in the same room as Russ, but judging by the lighting, how's it going, Tom?
It's good. If I look to my right, there's Russ just at another desk. Yeah, no, great, mate. Great. Really good.
Excellent. So the reason I am taking over hosting duties is because Tom is taking the lead on this one. And it's a subject he, in fact, knows quite a lot about. It's a subject that he quite enjoys. I was going to make a
it's
joke
not
there,
3D
but
printing.
It's not 3D printing, no. No,
that'll
be coming at some point, I'm sure. And I dare say we'll talk about it at some point. We're going to do something that we wanted to do for about a year now, with a series we call Deep Dive. I know that's not really very original, and I'm pretty certain that happens
None
a
of
lot.
This is original.
None of it's original, but we want to talk...
The concept of talking. We did invent that.
We did. That was us. We want to move on from love letters to something like a little bit more in depth, where we actually talk about like production of things and not just why we love it, not just quoting things, but actually what came about to produce something that we absolutely adore and what it is specifically about it that we absolutely adore. So yeah, deep dives, and Tom is kicking it off. This has been in the works for about a year, hasn't it, Tom?
It has. I mean, it's gone through several refinements because obviously we stream maybe for an hour or so. And I think doing a deep dive, I feel like we have to kind of pick and choose the bits we dive deeply into of the bits of the thing. So I think, you know, obviously this is a sort of format that's going to refine itself over the sort of course of more of us doing it. But I've effectively
think of this
sort
as a
of
pilot.
I've effectively it's maybe not the one that sells it, but it's the one that everyone goes, oh, okay, I understand what you mean now. Sort of thing. So I split it up into three kind of main sections.
I haven't said what it is yet.
No, that's true.
So what we're going to do is we are going to look at one of Tom's favorite films, Sexy Pegging Nuns 6. Yes.
One of the wettest films ever.
No, it's Alien. It's Alien. I only held Tom back because I wanted to make that joke. It's Alien. You'll have seen it actually on the screen whilst we're talking, or the podcast itself. But yes, Tom, take it away. Tell us about Alien.
Okay, so this is good.
And that's
this
what
is...
he was prepping for. Congratulations.
Very good. Well done, Duncan. Okay, are we all ready?
I reckon
happy flying
we
from
got
the
pegging
seat
joke
pants.
Out the way. Duncan's done the thing where
Alien.
He pretends like something's coming out of his stomach. That's always good, yeah.
If so, I feel I can't contribute something in this, I will probably bring up about parasites, because just like Tom brings up 3D printing comparison.
It's very true. I do.
I'm gonna bring some light to this.
Actually, Tom, this time for real, with no one interrupting you, take it away.
Hello, I am Tom Roberts, and this is the Alien Deep Dive. So my favorite film, Dan was very modest in his description of it as one of my favorite. It is undoubtedly my favorite film. I think it's probably one of the tightest movies out there. I mean, its legacy is incredibly enduring. It's spawned a massive franchise, and in fact linked up with a couple of other franchises as well over the years. Probably most notably in the sort of modern zeitgeist, I would imagine the Aliens versus Predator universe is has become quite well established, and it all started with Alien. So my favorite film, Alien, it premiered on May 25th, 1979, long time ago.
So it's also not a fucking Christmas film.
It's also not a Christmas film at all. I mean, yeah. It's not set at Christmas, wasn't released at Christmas. But the story of the film, of how it came together, Alien, is fascinating, and it involves innovative filmmaking, you know, not just in terms of the film itself was an innovative story. It was, the way it was shot was innovative. The model work, the art design, it had a visionary director at its helm, Ridley Scott, who, despite only having done one movie at the time, ended up directing the absolute pants off this film. And it also had a very talented cast of very, very good individuals who were probably helped in the sense that only a couple of them were really particularly quite established by that point. And it sort of sold that kind of look of normal people living just a sort of a life, doing a job in space in this kind of used future. But anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself because I have split this up into sections where we look at those individual bits. So here is an in-depth look at the making of this iconic science fiction horror film. So let's take a little trip into pre-production. So I've tried to, obviously I don't want to just waffle on, right? I mean, please, everyone, feel free to jump in with observations and things like that, at any point, don't Tom, feel like, yeah.
Does pre-production happen before production?
Yeah, so the prefix pre means that the thing has come before. Yeah. So pre-production, pre-lunch, pre-dinner drinks. You know what I mean? So yeah,
pre-processing.
Pre-processing, yeah, absolutely.
Pre-cum.
Pre-cum. Pre-dissemination. Pre-production. So conception. The concept for Alien originated from a screenplay by Dan O'Bannon, who was inspired by his love for science fiction horror to write a script about a crew of people who encounter some kind of alien life form. From there, he collaborated with a guy called Ronald Shusett to develop the script, which went through a lot of revisions. I mean, this is the thing that people, I think, sometimes underestimate, that this was a refined story from start to finish, all nicely encapsulated and kind of went through production very easily. No, actually, the pre-production and especially the conception stage of Alien, especially the refinements to the script, took a long time. And it was a bit of a hard sell. I think people were worried at the time that it was going to be another kind of horror B-movie with, like, you know, dirty aliens from space. And weren't really sold in. Probably the first couple of revisions, I don't think even featured anything that we would recognize. And it was only through careful revisions, especially those that were suggested by the studio. You know, this is one of the times when 20th Century Fox actually deserves some credit, because it was them that decided to tighten it up and actually limit the cast so that they could put more money into actually achieving the look and the feel, and we'll get to that bit as well. From a directorial vision point of view, Ridley Scott was chosen to direct the film despite having only one feature film under his belt, which was a film called The Duelists. And it's kind of amazing, really. You almost think to yourself, Ridley Scott proved himself to be something of almost a prodigy. You know, the sort of the late 70s and the early 80s, I think, Dan, you might back me up, you've got a far more sort of a keen knowledge of this kind of stuff when it comes to sort of film and feature films. But there seemed to be this sort of presence of young filmmakers at the pioneering edge of, new shooting techniques, model work, and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, to the point that the things that they've created still hold up and look really good. It's almost like going back and watching Jurassic Park. Like, it still holds up. Like, it still looks good. It still looks like a people film.
Yeah, like it, when, they were ambitious but not over ambitious. Like it was new, untested stuff. So they just did what they could to really add a bit to it, whereas as opposed to just going, oh, we'll do it all in computers.
The thing about picking Ridley Scott is that he also, at this time anyway, he would have still been heavily influenced by where he essentially grew up, Teesside.
Mm.
And like, when you look at Teesside, like obviously they've got Blade Runner, but even the Alien set, you look at it, it's grim, it's dark, it's industrial, which is Teesside in the 70s. Like grim, dark, industrial, damp, and probably unbeknownst horrors there. I mean, Middlesbrough, full of horrors to this day.
So, and at this point,
I made no apologies.
All he directed, was The Duelist, and before then, all he'd done was TV commercials.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was like director of photography work. So, like, it wasn't necessarily even as a director, but then the fact that he did this and then went on to do things like Blade Runner. And you're absolutely right, Tom. There's like directors like obviously John Carpenter, like mid to late 70s as well, with Halloween and then The Thing and then all the other films John Carpenter's done. Steven Spielberg, obviously. James Cameron as well.
George Lucas.
The amount of talented directors that were pumping out like sci-fi and fantasy, or not even necessarily sci-fi and fantasy, but doing things a little bit bolder with animatronics or stop motion, but like model work at least. And as you say, not taking it too far, but putting it in a believable sense. Having the common sense to take a step back and go, actually, the shark looks shit, so let's maybe not see it for most of this film. That kind of thing. So, yeah.
That's really, thank you for that. I mean, that's some really good examples of the types of, it's one of those things, like, you know, when you sort of try and think and you go, I know there are lots of people, but who are really pioneering at the point, but I can't fucking remember their names for like the life of me. But someone, as we move on to design and artwork, as you can see, I'm just kind of pulling, this was the sort of the team that were being pulled together, you know, once the script had been signed off and that they knew that they needed some kind of creature, they started looking around for, inspiration on what this creature should look like. And it's absolutely bizarre because, you know, the thing I love most about Alien is the juxtaposition between just how familiar and lived in the human world feels, especially in the Nostromo spaceship, and how utterly alien the alien truly is, you know, with its biomechanical body, its weird long head and carapace. It's, you know, very, very, very alien. Like, you know, it's incredible growth rate and all that kind of, I mean, it's just so, you know, with the face hugger as well, it's so bizarre and so unsettling that, you know, it could have only come from one person's mind, and that person's was H.R. Giger, who was a Swiss artist, very famous for some of his incredibly surreal work. Now, the one that inspired the aliens design was a piece of work called Biomechanoid, and I think it was Necronomicon 4 or something, I think is the rest of the title of it, but it's this Biomechanoid, which is this very sort of bizarre female form, very sexualized, but with this very long head and, you know, the jaw that, you know, comes out of the alien's mouth, very, very present. So this design had obviously been going through his head before. Again, it completely becomes the signature element of the film. He even designs the derelict ship as well as the facehugger. Although, now, I didn't know this until I started researching this, was that the design of the facehugger is, at the first stages, completely different to what we see. So the facehugger that was eventually created, the iconic sort of thing that looks like kind of two hands, you know, that come at your face, it didn't really look like that. It actually looked like one large hand with a sort of kind of turkey frill over the back of it and one great big eyeball in the middle. It looked bizarre. It looked very, very odd. And the novelization that was written from Dan O'Bannon's script still uses that description of the face hugger, that there's the, while it's on Kane's face, it's looking at them with this panicked sort of eye, hoping that they're
the eyes on top.
It's got a one single big eye on its on the top of it, which is really bizarre. And you just think it's very strange. So in the novelization, it's got the description of the creature matches the first design, because the novelization was written from the original. I think the sort of the script itself that had this first design before Ridley Scott said it looks ridiculous. We need to do something else. So Geiger redesigned the creature, and he sort of cast it in that sort of weird sort of, you know, that rubber that they would sort of take an animatronic skeleton and just kind of like fling rubber at it, like superheated rubber, and just like kind of let it cool down and stick to the frame. And it kind of came out in this sickly gray color that we see on the film. And initially they were going to paint it, but Ridley Scott and I think Geiger both were looking at it going, it doesn't need to be painted. It looks horrible. And when you see later Ash digging around in it, you know, sort of after they found it dead, all of the internals, the innards of the face hugger creature are made from like fish, like cuttlefish and bits and bobs. And,
lovely.
You know, it all looks grim. And apparently they absolutely stank on set. Absolutely stank. Really, really minging.
Well, because that would have been there for hours under like hours. Burning hot studio lights.
Exactly. And absolutely stank the place out. The egg was no different. When the egg opens up, you see this kind of pulsating gelatinous mass that was cow stomach lining. An intestinal tract all sort of pulled into a big mess. Again, stank the set out. You know, and I believe a lot of the stuff that they used in the first film to create those kind of alien bodies and things like that were used in the later films as well. So, of course, when Bishop is dissecting the face hugger in the second film, that's all very much the same stuff. It's cuttlefish entrails and all that kind of stuff. So, obviously, Geiger created the alien, the egg, the ship, and the face hugger creature, and also, sorry, the iconic space jockey. So we kind of get to a point when I've sort of said a lot of stuff here. It's probably worth kind of just giving a little bit of a recap of the film. I mean, the basic kind of plot of the film is commercial spaceship flying through space on its way back home, tugging a great big massive oil refinery behind it. The ship in question is a tugboat called the Nostromo. There's a crew of, 7. 7 crew members and one ship's cat. They're on their way home. They suddenly get woken up out of nowhere. They go onto the ship's bridge to try and find out what's going on, but the ship's central computer tells the captain, you've been woken up early, you're nowhere near home. There's a distress signal that we've picked up. You need to go and check it out. There's a bit of banter and arguing and stuff like that, but they eventually decide, right, fine. So they disconnect the Nostromo from the refinery. They land on this planet, LV-426, which is basically just a number designation given to this planet that obviously has been surveyed at some point, and it's just it's just assigned that number, you know, something to look at later. They land, they find this very sort of primordial planet that is very much in the young stages of its life. They home in on the signal, and instead of just finding some people in trouble, they find a very, very alien looking vessel. They have no idea how it flies. It looks like it's crashed on the planet. And they go inside, they find the source of the signal, and they find a dead pilot's body, big alien thing that looks like it's been fossilized with its ribcage exploded from the inside. So there's already sort of this very unsettling sort of, you know, they've been woken up, then, you know, the actors are already bringing across this, like, this is completely unexpected. They didn't want, you know, they just wanted to go home. But they decide to lower one of their crew members into this, into what they think is the hold of the ship. And they encounter a massive room filled with what looks like millions upon millions of eggs. This crew member approaches one of the eggs. The facehugger jumps out, bursts through his helmet, and they drag him back to the ship.
It's the way the egg peels back so slowly, the petals.
Absolutely. And indeed, we will have a look at that a little bit later. And they drag him back to the ship. They argue about whether they should just freeze him and get back into the freezer and go home, or whether they should, you know, try and work out what's wrong with him first. Ash, the science officer, says, I don't think it's wise putting him into freezing. I think we should just run tests. Eventually, he wakes up, and they try to remove the face hugger at one point and find that the face hugger itself has acid for blood, like nearly melts through the hull of the ship. You know, so there's no way to remove this face hugger from Kane, and eventually it actually comes off and dies. And Ash is given permission to take it back to Earth. And then eventually Kane wakes up, and they all think, brilliant, he's going to be happy. They decide to have one last meal before bed. And that's when the most iconic, and probably one of the most iconic film scenes in cinema happens. Halfway through dinner, Kane starts convulsing and choking, and the alien bursts from within his chest, and Kane's son, the xenomorph, is born.
I thought of it like that.
Yeah, it's very, very strange. Now, the thing is that obviously, you know, calling it Kane's son is a bit flippant. One of the main themes of the film is, you know, without sort of dashing around it too much, is male rape, is the fear of it, is that, you know, the face hugger puts a tube, you know, grabs hold of the face, puts a tube down the throat, implants an alien egg into the chest cavity, and the alien eats its way out and bursts all out. You know, it's a really, it's a violation, and the alien is a violating creature. So they decide, we need to capture this thing. They've seen it burst out. They think it's about sort of yay big, about a foot high. So they make some cattle prods and nets, and they go and try and chase it. But they find very quickly that the alien has unbelievable metabolism and has grown, you know, to the, about 8 foot tall. And they encounter, and basically it starts picking off the crew one by one. Captain Dallas decides he's going to go into the vents to try and flush it out towards the airlock. Hopefully they'll be able to get this thing out before it kills any more of the crew. But ultimately what happens is basically everyone gets killed, except for Ripley and the cat. She decides to destroy the Nostromo and fly away in the shuttle. But ultimately what happens is finds that once she's blown up the Nostromo and flies away,
three of them go, right, let's do self-destruct.
Yes. So the one thing I've missed out is actually what they find out in the middle. I mean, that would be the great story, that she escapes, she kills the alien, and blah, blah, blah. But actually what we find out is that one of the crew members is a sleeper agent, and Ash has been sent out by the company, as they are known, who run the company that owns the Nostromo tug vessel. They were sent out there because it actually wasn't a distress signal. It was a warning that had been set up by whatever alien race actually owned the ship. It was a warning to stay away from the ship because of the cargo it was carrying. Ash, it turns out, is actually an android sent by the company to get the alien back at all costs. And his special order 937 actually tells him that the lives of the crew are secondary to bringing back the alien. So it could have just been a standard encounter alien, kill it, and there's one survivor kind of story. But actually the idea of this sort of bigger antagonist behind it, you know, I don't think had been done as well as Alien. It adds an extra layer of horror where you have this whole sort of maybe humans are the more monstrous monster than the monster kind of conversation, that this company would actually throw its employees into harm's way to get an alien life form that it has no idea how to control back to Earth.
Yeah, or even really what they're going to do with it.
Well, they always have this flippant throwaway thing where they say, oh, the bioweapons division. And it's like, how the hell is this a bioweapon? Like, I mean, it's like you can't control it. You have no way of antidoting it, like making an antidote for this. This thing will just kill everything. And then it will be very hard for you to then kill it off afterwards. So even if you kill all of your enemies, it's still, you're still going to have land that's infested with these horrible xenomorphs that you don't want to try and fight.
Well, if the bioweapons people in shady mega corporations thought clearly, there'd be a lot of films that didn't exist.
Yeah, that's true.
Quite.
I mean, the fight scene between Ash and Ripley is iconic because that is, forget the rest of the thing, that is the fight for survival.
Yeah.
Because he is super strong. He's an android. He's super strong, feels no pain. He takes a hell of a lot of punishment and very much nearly kills Ripley.
Unbelievable behavior by Bill.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and this is the point. You know, the Ash betrayal is almost like the, you know, you can even see it in Ripley's face when she realizes what's been going on. Is this almost this desperate kind of everything we've tried? Ash has been actively fighting them. Like, you know, even the motion trackers that he creates don't quite work. You know, they just
like,
measure
it's like how if he hadn't been doing that and had been actively helping them, they'd probably have been fine.
Probably would have been fine. And it's, you know, it's a testament really to the ability, because it's actually an odd scene. It's never really explained what happens to Ash. You know, there's that moment where Ripley finds out about Special Order 937 and he's there next to her and he goes, it's not what you know, I can explain, sort of almost in this very sinister way. She pushes him back. And I think there's a lot of people who kind of think, well, I mean, you know, a lot of people would probably watch it and think she pushes him back with such force that, you know, maybe she damages his android body. You know, he starts to leak a sort of a milky white substance from his forehead. So maybe like she's cracked his synthetic skull or something. But actually, I read this very interesting sort of analysis of the Ash character where it said, if you consider that, you know, what Bishop tells us about the Hyperdyne system 120A2's always being a bit twitchy, he talks about how that could never happen now because of our behavioral inhibitors. Of course, it's the I can't remember what it is. What's Asimov? Is it the five laws or the three laws or something like that?
It's five laws of robotics.
Five laws of robotics. So, you know, one of them is that you can't allow by omission of action a human to come to harm.
Three laws. Because they
can't directly harm a human.
Yeah. And the idea is that basically at some point they will always kind of like go against these anyway.
So Ash is like, you know, so Bishop's model line has in behavioral inhibitors, so they can't do things. Whereas it's kind of implied, because of, you know, Ash literally being a voluntary sleeper agent, you know, that actually his malfunction is because he realizes that the only way to complete his mission is to kill Ripley, which is something that he shouldn't do. But he knows that he's already been told that the lives of the crew are not a secondary to getting the alien back. So his malfunction is probably more likely caused by a programming conflict, which because it's actually when he starts to try and kill her that his most violent eruption of, you know, his kind of his processing fluid and everything starts going, and he actually has his massive sort of flip out where he can't control his movements after he's pushed away from her. And you know, that is the bit for me that kind of brings me round to the fact that someone can play that and there are people still talking about this 50 years on, just as a credit to the crew, the cast, sorry, that were pulled together for this. So obviously everyone knows Sigourney Weaver as Ellen Ripley, but some of the sort of the names that may have sort of passed into kind of acting lore by now are Tom Skerritt, played Captain Dallas, the captain of the Nostromo, John Hurt, who very famously played Kane, the guy that gets impregnated with the alien. You've got Ian Holm, who played Ash, as we were just discussing. You've got Yaphet Kotto, who played Parker, the chief engineer. You've got Harry Dean Stanton, who played Brett, who was the sort of deputy engineer. And you've got Veronica Cartwright, who plays Lambert, who's the navigation officer.
Harry Dean Stanton is like the character actor. He is like, if you are going to like find like a character actor, define him, there'll be a picture of Harry Dean Stanton next to him. But
yeah, absolutely. And there's some interesting things. You know, Ellen Ripley, played by Sigourney Weaver, she was considered for the role first. Oh no, sorry. So Meryl Streep was considered for the role.
I read that the other day.
That's crazy.
But she, I think her partner died, so she decided not to do it. Weaver was actually on Broadway. Ridley Scott had seen her and he was really impressed, and she was actually the last actor to be cast, which I think is quite interesting. You know, I mean, it's one of those things that where people sort of go, oh my god, she was the last actor to be cast in the film, and she went on to be like this most iconic character. And it's like, you you know, let's just see it for what it is. It was an administrative thing. They probably cast the character last just through whatever. They, you know, it wasn't, it's not necessarily this sort of legendary story anymore. She simply was, at an administrative level, the last person to be cast in her character.
Mm.
Funnily enough, Veronica Cartwright actually auditioned for Ripley and thought she got the job. But when she went for costume fittings in London, found out that she'd been cast as Lambert, initially was a bit worried that the emotional nature of the character was a little bit of a weak character for her to play, but then decided, actually, you know, I'd just like to be in the film. She deserves a special mention because during the chest burster scene, while they didn't actually know more about what the scene was going to contain than I think most people assume that they didn't know anything that was going to happen during that.
Yeah, which would be cruel as fuck, by the way, and they should never do that.
Really cruel, and they should never do it. And in fact, they didn't. I mean, they knew sort of what was going to happen, that there was going to be a thing, but they had no idea how violently visceral it was going to be. Yeah. Veronica Cartwright certainly did not expect to be showered with blood. So her scream is real, as is Tom Skerritt's shell-shocked kind of look on his face as the thing runs away off the table. You know, those reactions are very, very much real.
They knew something was coming out, but they weren't expecting everything that was. They kept more things in there, and they didn't expect the explosion either.
No.
I mean, the whole setup with the chest burst a bit is amazing piece of, like, animatronic. Well, not animatronic, but, you know,
it's done a thousand times now, but like that when that first happened, like, I can remember really clearly the first time I saw
oh my god
that scene. Especially like a lot about seeing this all for the first time. Like, I'd only ever known Ian Holm as Pod from The Borrowers. So, you know, that's a bit of a character change.
Some Jack's made some fun points. I kind of want to, if people want to, Jack knows something about Alien, quite a lot about Alien himself. So he, a lot of the look of the Alien was inspired by the kind of used future look of the tech in Star Wars as well.
Mm. Yes.
And he says all of them except Ripley would have definitely died of COVID. And then also Yaphet Kotto grabbed a fork to stab it when it appeared. This is very
it's curious. Actually it's actually a skillet that he it's not a fork, I think it's a skillet that he grabs. While we're talking about that, actually, I've just found a really good description of it. For the filming of the chest burster scene, the cast members knew that the creature would be bursting out of hurt and had seen the puppet, but they'd not been told that fake blood would be bursting out in every direction from high pressure pumps and squibs. So can you imagine that moment of, okay, so this thing, like, that looks a bit weird and a bit lame, probably, like, is going to burst out. And they're like, all right, cool. Yeah, okay, well, we'll act shocked and stuff like that. And then suddenly, bang, splat, kapow, everything goes. It says that, you know, the stream of blood shot directly over Veronica Cartwright, like literally cut. And you can see it in the film, covers it. And she actually fell to the floor and went into hysterics. She was so shocked with what was happening. And interestingly enough, when the alien runs away and it looks a bit lame because the tail is wiggling around, that was created by an air pump blowing air out the back of this thing and a slit in the table that it was just being pushed along. So it's, you know, I mean, it's probably the one scene in the whole film that I look at and go, it's the one that I just, that when it runs away, I think, that's the only lame bit, because it's flanked by so much other cool stuff. Like, you know, this is what the deep dive stuff is all about. Mm. Like, do you guys know how they created the acid for blood scene where they try to cut digits of the facehugger off to try and free it from Kane?
It melts through like four decks of the ships, doesn't it?
And it splashes onto the floor and there's this dissolving noise.
Is it something like, is it like polystyrene and super glue?
I was about to say polystyrene cement.
And nail polish remover.
Yeah.
Acetone.
So,
yeah.
So basically they made the models of the boot and the floor tile and stuff like that. In fact, if you're an eagle-eyed viewer, you can see that one of the drops of the blood fluid hits Tom Skerritt's boot and nothing happens. But when
this is the sort of thing that you'd spot on like a 4K remaster that, like, you would never have had a chance.
Yeah, literally, I've only ever spotted it on the Blu-ray, like, as it's happened. And obviously the effect of throwing nail polish remover in that sort of splash pattern onto polystyrene is that very quick, almost dissolving, like, but it's actually just melting. It's just melting the plastic really, really quickly. And of course, they use that all the way through. So that's why it's such a small sort of area of roofs and things like that, because obviously it's very difficult to model out of polystyrene and stuff. But that's how they achieved that.
That's really cool.
That wonderful effect.
It looks brilliant. Where it's all like drippy, sticky.
Yeah.
Horrible. It looks so cool.
And
it
still kind of
genuinely corrosive as well. Like it looks like you wouldn't want that on you. Like you're such
absolutely.
A good job at making it.
And
like,
in fact, it's, you know, that sort of effect becomes almost, you know, I mean, it becomes one of the iconic things about the creature is that, you know, I mean, even the Parker character sums it up when he goes, like, it's got a wonderful defense mechanism. You don't dare kill it. Mm. And once it's in a ship like the Nostromo, you think to yourself, you know, the fact is it almost ate through the hull. It neutralized only one deck away from the outside of the ship and space. So, you know, killing the alien becomes something they just cannot possibly risk, because if the facehugger had acid for blood, it's very likely that the adult version of whatever they're chasing has it as well.
Yeah, it's such a cool moment. That's one of those things that, like, even now, that would be quite a hard thing to get looking really good with CG. Because it's like fluid sims interacting with hard surface modeling. It would be really difficult to do. You probably wouldn't be able to get it looking much better than they did then. Even these days, you'd probably still do it practically.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you know what? We have actually seen almost a return to practical effects over the last decade, which is probably a good thing, really, because there's a lot of films that have come out that look better because they are... like. And that is one of the things, you know, the whole of the set and everything was life-size. Apart from the interior of the ship and the space jockey model, which in a very odd inversion, the model was life-size, as in it was very, very big. But to make it look even bigger, Ridley Scott got his kids to wear some super miniature little spacesuits.
Oh, nice.
And that scene when it pans out from the space jockey and you see the small humans walking in, it's because they are literally small humans.
No sort of like clever forced perspective or matte painting. It's just
children. Kids in spacesuits.
Nice.
Which I think is wonderful. It's one of my favorite little stories. So, I mean, obviously, you know, full credit go to Ron Cobb, who provided the realistic and lived-in feel of the spaceship. Film in general, just to give people obviously the credit they deserve, produced by Gordon Carroll, David Giler, and Walter Hill, through a company called Brandywine Productions, obviously 20th Century Fox with a distributor. Giler and Hill, who were also producers, were actually two of the people who helped revise and make additions to the script. And Shissett was actually added as executive producer as he got a bit closer, almost a reward for helping to bring everything together as a concept.
And well done them on changing the name from its original working title was Star Beast.
Well, quite. Yes, it doesn't have quite the ring to it as Alien.
I disagree.
No.
It's got more of a B-movie vibe to it, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Brian Johnson and his team are the ones that created all the practical effects for the aliens, taking the fantastic designs from Geiger and turning them into real things. The puppet of the little chest burster was actually forced up through a hole in a fake torso. If you look at how John Hurt is lying, you can see that he's actually sort of, he's just got the top of his torso. Yeah.
That's what I was meaning.
That's one of the... like, if you look at a lot of Geiger's artwork, you think, yeah, that is amazing, but you couldn't actually make that for real. Like, a lot of sort of physically impossible.
Yes. but they made it nonetheless.
I mean, a lot of the alien, the ship that they go into is also, it's all Geiger.
It's all the texture and scale of it is also off. Like, nothing feels the right size. It just makes it...
but that's only because the space jockey is actually just a suit that bald-headed blue people jump inside.
Well, I mean, Prometheus is ruined. You know, has a lot to answer for that.
I fucking love Prometheus as well, but like, that bit is a bit like, oh come on. One of the good things about the space jockey was it looked completely otherworldly, like nothing you'd imagine. Not just really... like a giant fucking ripped Moby was jumping in it. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, you know. I mean,
Moby.
I completely sympathize with people and empathize with people who find it hard to think back and almost put themselves in the position of, if you knew that this film was on its own completely, take it on its own merits at the time when you watch that and you see that creature that literally has a minute or two of screen time and it's found sort of almost fused to its chair and held in place rather than, as we find out in Prometheus, wearing a suit. You know, it's actually a very scary thing. You think, well, fucking hell, how long has this ship been here? Like, is that the hold? Because, you know, when they actually go down, it looks like this thing, like this room, this area of the ship stretches on for miles and miles and miles. Mm. And like you say, Russ, all the dimensions seem completely wrong. And it's just utterly bizarre. But again, that comes down to, I think, good editing. You know, there are some really fantastic choices with how this film was edited and put together.
Oh.
So Terry Rawlings edited the film, working very closely with Ridley Scott to create a suspenseful and engaging narrative. The editing played a crucial role, I think, in maintaining the film's tension, but at the same time not turning it into a superfluous waste of time. So what I mean by that is, when they were filming, a lot of superfluous scenes were filmed, usually, and actually most of them set before they encounter the alien, showing life on the ship, you know, like Tom Skerritt getting breakfast and filling up the coffee pot, and, you know, really mundane stuff. They really wanted initially to kind of show the ship as a working home for these people, but eventually realized that actually you could cut most of that stuff out and just skip straight to their breakfast, straight to Mother alerting Dallas that there's something, you know, that there's a distress signal, and straight into the film, you know, makes a lot more sense. Because that is the crux of this whole, it's seven people versus an alien organism. But actually you don't really meet the alien until about halfway through the film, when it suddenly arrives.
Yeah, it's still a very fleeting presence, you know.
Yeah.
What I really like about it is a proper horror movie, but it's in the same way that, you know, it got quite a lot of budget because of Star Wars, but in the same way that Star Wars is a fairy tale in space, this is a haunted house plus cursed object in space. And it really does the thing of, well, there's no escape here. Like, they cannot leave. It is nigh on, you know, with the burning blood, they go, well, we can't kill it. So how, we can't, in, you know, the trappedness, the claustrophobia is fantastic, especially the duct scene. You know, Dallas going up there is, the whole thing builds the claustrophobia, because that opening bit where the ship is asleep and then starts waking up, that's just still spooky. That is still kind of scary.
It's what they use as the film goes on to get more claustrophobic, but I'm sure Tom's going to get into this. So I don't want to like blow his load for him, because one of the things I was going to say,
we've heard his voice enough. So you might as well.
Now, the three things that make this film is the direction, like how each of the characters react to anything is perfect. The editing, as you're right, it is tight. Like you get everything you need to see and nothing else. And the third thing is, as Duncan kind of mentioned, the claustrophobia, which is headed up by some of the best special effects in a horror film ever.
Absolutely.
Like when the lights go down, it's just flashing light.
As I say, Tom's got a script, and I'm sure he's going to get to it. So like, yeah.
It's funny, because that is literally the next segment is absolutely that. The human areas of the Nostromo. As Duncan says, you know, this whole sort of ship comes to life at the beginning of the film, and it's all very nice. It looks lived in. But, you know, the sort of overarching theme is lovely padded walls, white light, you know, this very sort of pure. And the themes of that is that, you know, they very much are emerging from the womb, the characters, and they are coming out into their, you know, into their sort of adult life and having breakfast together as a family. But it is all very claustrophobic. You know, there's not much headroom in many of these places. But then suddenly in some areas of the ship, of the Nostromo, there's like that massive area where Brett is killed by the alien.
Mm.
With all the enormous, chains hanging down.
With all the chains, exactly, yeah. And the water and the vent and stuff like that as they're looking through. And I think it's not just the visual design that sells this sense of claustrophobia. It's the music.
It's the sound effects, yeah.
Which were designed by Ron Cobb and composer Jeremy Goldsmith.
As soon as that alarm starts going off as well.
You know, it's absolutely incredible. And, you know, there is no traditional score for this this film. There are musical cues, there are sort of almost whimsical, kind of dreamy noises. But one of the most pervading sounds in that film is a very, very subtle.
Yeah.
Like a subtle changing, almost as if the ship is breathing.
Yeah.
And, you know, Duncan, you sort of almost hit on it, really. I think the ship Nostromo is seen as a living organism, and Mother, the central computer, who is supposed to be looking after the crew, is actively working with Ash as well to make sure that they, you know, don't get in the way of the company's goals, which is to get the alien back, which again is another layer of claustrophobia as well. You know, Ash's one response whenever they ask for any help is Mother is still collating. She's not collating. She's not doing anything. She's literally actively not doing anything to help. Even when Dallas asks, what are my chances? When he goes into the vent, she answers insufficient data. Mm. And that is what she's been programmed to do. So she's not... The funny thing is, Mother is not necessarily a malevolent force, but has been perverted by the company into a malevolent force. Ash is a malevolent force created by the company. Their influence is a claustrophobic presence. The alien, as I called it earlier, is a violating presence on the ship. Not only does it physically violate your body to impregnate you and then kills you when it erupts, it then violates the space. And Duncan said it absolutely right. It can't be killed. So it is a violate. You know, the only way you can get it out of the ship is by flushing it out into space and hoping that will kill it, which it turns out not even that can actually kill the alien, because Ripley in the end has to kill the alien by frying it with the engines of the Narcissus. I think Narcissus is that how you pronounce it.
That's the little shuttle at the end, isn't it?
The little shuttle.
Yeah.
And again, you know, that is a very claustrophobic set. The Narcissus is an escape shuttle, tiny, single room with a little bridge and one hypersleep pod. And the alien has gotten on there. So not only has she destroyed the massive ship that they were living on, just to find that the alien was in that little shuttle all along. Now, there are some people who say that the alien went to the shuttle to die because the drones don't have very long lives there. Their purpose is to not kill off the crew, not kill off people as they suspect, but actually they're taking them somewhere. And it turns out in one of the deleted scenes for Alien that the alien has set up a small hive, where it has imprisoned Dallas and kept him alive and is turning Brett's body into an egg, showing that the xenomorphs can almost asexually reproduce. Which again is very claustrophobic and very scary, and is so weird and alien. And I absolutely love that. I mean, so it, you know, the film did garner a lot of critical acclaim for its innovative use of visuals, tension, groundbreaking special effects. It was a massive commercial success, became a cultural phenomenon, leading to a franchise that includes I think we could probably argue forever which film is better, Alien or Aliens. But without Alien, you don't get Aliens. Is my one mic drop moment on that.
They're kind of both perfect. Yeah. And both very different.
I personally prefer Alien, but you can't... There can't be an argument for without this, you don't get this. Because that's like saying, well, without films, you don't get any of them. Yeah. Fine.
You don't need to say which one's better.
I just think Alien is
a better one. It doesn't mean it's better.
Yeah, no, and I think Alien is just a better film, just in general. I love them both.
They're different. They're also really different.
Yeah.
About them is different. Alien.
Yeah.
Aliens is a survival horror.
It's a Christmas film. You're right.
It's like the zombie. It's a zombie. It's essentially the zombie
But it's also an action zombie movie horde. and a Vietnam movie, and you know, all sorts of other different things. But let's talk about the alien going there. Like, I don't know if I agree with trying to ascribe too much purpose to the alien, because part of what makes it so scary is you don't know why it's doing this. It doesn't have a purpose. It's just killing everybody.
Yeah.
And if you sort of know, oh, it's got a backstory and it had a difficult upbringing, you know, don't try and. I don't think you should try to. Like, part of what makes Alien so good is the alien is so alien.
Yeah.
So trying to give it motivations and a purpose that you would understand takes away from that. So I think it was a good move getting rid of that stuff.
Yeah, I border every now and then on completely agreeing with that point of view. Mm. I feel like with what happens in Aliens, that scene makes more sense almost, you know, but, you know, it still makes the alien, like, in the sense of like, oh my God, it's literally transforming a person into an egg.
Yeah.
Like, that's a bit fucked up. You know what I mean? Okay, but you're going to say something that not many people will know. So, like,
it's basically just gooshing inside, though, isn't it? Like, that's essentially what it is. It's impregnating.
Well, a lot of parasites, like, if a lot of things will take the dominant role. So if the queen is dead or something, the main breeder is dead, then something else will actually turn into that main breeder. So that drone, it makes kind of sense. Well, to me, it makes sense that it would
it would turn into a queen. Yeah, yeah. So you're absolutely right. But then again, that's like saying, oh, so this happens to creatures on Earth, therefore it will probably happen with these.
Well, this is why Ash's comments about the alien ring so true. So after the fight,
he's talking about his nobility of purpose.
Ash is reactivated by the crew in his discombobulated state, which, by the way, was created by milk, fiber optic cables, which you can see sort of glowing, and macaroni and beads is what all the internals are made from. And there's also a very funny moment where, unfortunately, the rubber head that they created for Ash dried out in the sun too much and shrunk, so the snap from rubber head being pushed onto a table to Ian Holm's actual head is very glaring. And actually, when I said that the alien chestburster running across the table was the only scene that I sort of sometimes a bit balk at, actually, okay, this one as well. But Ash's final words are something to the effect of, you still don't know what you're dealing with. It's a perfect organism, a survivor, unclouded by petty delusions of morality. You know, I can't lie to you about your chances, but you have my sympathy. You know, effectively saying that he admires its purity.
Yeah.
It's the perfect organism. All it does is survive. It has no interest in sympathy, fear, nothing. It just wants to survive. And I think
just
that's
needs
the point.
Biomass.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the point, isn't it? You know, actually, that's Ash trying to rationalize the alien for them, to kind of give them some grounding so that they understand that it's utterly beyond their comprehension. You know, it is so inhuman in its goals that they're just almost unknowable. I guess that's almost kind of Cthulhu-like, isn't it? It's like, it's just so unfathomably unknowable. So legacy, I mean, influence on sci-fi and horror. Alien, often regarded as one of the greatest science fiction horror films, influencing numerous filmmakers in the genre. And, you know, you can see Alien's influence even to this day in horror films. Any haunted house horror film has taken some.
I don't know what you're talking about, Tom. There is no influence across multimedias of popular culture whatsoever.
Clearly not. The film received Academy Award nominations for Best Art Direction and Best Visual Effects, which was very, very good and very well deserved. The success of the first film obviously led to Aliens, which is directed by James Cameron. Alien 3, and Alien Resurrection, and Aliens vs. Predator. And, you know, yes, very much the quality of the films sort of reach their peak with
Keep
Aliens.
Keep saying the films, Tom. Gets I mean, the I like. Talk about.
Aliens vs. Predator 2. Aliens vs. Predator Requiem. And then Predator. You know, I mean, Prometheus. There's a lot of these franchises. Yeah, Prometheus.
Say the other
Covenant.
One, Tom. Say it.
Covenant. Boo! Boo! Covenant. Shit! Boo! Totally shit! Oh, apparently
that film.
Apparently, Michael Fassbender made the aliens. Yeah, that's what happens, is it? Yeah. So it's all gone a bit weird since then. But you know, the cultural impact of the films cannot be underestimated at all. I'm not just talking about, you know, the iconic chest bursting scene or the design of the alien itself, things that have become so ingrained in pop culture that they have been spoofed at times. You know, Spaceballs spoofs that scene, and John Hurt, in fact, replays
it. I can't believe they got him to do it,
which is utterly
and he goes, oh no, not again.
Yeah. and the alien jumps out and does a cabaret dance. Like, you know. But I think, you know, what for me, you know, the production of Alien, the fact that it became what it is now, stands as testament to the efforts of the collaborative efforts of a visionary director, talented cast and crew, groundbreaking design work, which resulted in what I consider to, and many others to consider, as a cinematic masterpiece that continues to captivate audiences decades after its release. Now, I'm conscious we're an hour through. I did actually put together two other sections, which I totally underestimated the length of the script and stuff like that. But I kind of...
Well, you underestimated how long you could warble on for.
Yeah, totally. But I think, yeah. So I've got a big section on Ellen Ripley and I've got a big section on Ash's betrayal.
Like you did to me last night. Maybe we'll split it in two.
Yeah, exactly. Like a Kit Kat. So what should I do? Should I get like kind of halfway through?
I'm thinking if you're at a natural stopping point.
Yeah.
We stop now.
Yeah, you've got about an hour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Come back.
Well, there we go.
Then we'll come back and do another one next week.
So I've taken a look at, so I think through that I've managed to hit pre-production, production, post-production, and legacy.
Mm.
And I think, after that, yeah, there's a nice big long section of analysis of Ripley's character and what she has become to cinema, and also to people in general. And then there's also a section on Ash's betrayal, because that is the big twist in the film.
Yeah.
And I think because of the importance of Weyland Yutani and the company and their insidious nature and the way that androids become heroes as well as suspicious members of the cast, I think, I think we've reached a good point there.
Yeah, if worst comes to worst, we could just literally then just have a chat about how much we love Alien as well.
Yeah, totally.
We could fit that in as well. A couple of points from Jack. Space Jockey was so much worse in the comics. He literally just sent me a picture of it as well. Holy shit, that's not good. He says they've got the new film next year and the TV show, and also apparently Carlo Rambaldi built functional alien head for the SFX as well.
Mm. Interesting deep dive fact about the alien head is that at the very front, underneath the transparent carapace that runs along the top of the head, right at the front is the top half of a human skull, showing the link between the father, mother, parent species that the parasite uses to... this is the point, isn't it? You've got the dog alien, Alien 3, that takes on certain canine characteristics.
Have you seen the behind the scenes footage of that?
Yeah.
And it's amazing.
It literally makes me laugh my head off.
It's so funny.
Which is really sad, because in Aliens, when you see the animatronic alien queen being articulated, you go, holy shit, this is what people used to do to make unbelievable monsters in cinema. And then you see the dog alien in Alien 3 and you're like, oh, they just twisted the legs round. It doesn't look right. And they painted it red. What's going on?
Yeah. And the dog refused to do what they asked it to.
Yeah, exactly. Lie down. Explode from the inside.
It's so funny. If you get your, it's all over like social. It had like a massive comeback recently. It's worth, if you can find the clip of the dog alien, it's definitely a whippet in an alien suit is top tier. Absolutely, Jack. Yeah, it is exactly what it is. It's amazing. Go find the footage. It's incredible.
So, well, I would say thank you very much for listening for that first, what might become part one of a couple of parts.
If you like us doing this,
well,
yeah, sorry, go on, Duncan.
I mean, let's face it, we were talking GW last week, Games Workshop last week. They would be a bit stuffed without Alien at the moment.
Yeah, they definitely nicked a bit off them, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like the fact that we're just talking about Ridley Scott's second best film, so that's nice. So it's just, I'll die on the hill that Blade Runner is a better film, but it's, they're both fucking great. If you like this format, then we'll happily do it more. And you want to let us know, then you can hit us up on the social medias, which is just TMTOH on all of them, pretty much Instagram and Facebook, maybe. I haven't checked it in a long time. Twitter. And come join the Discord. It's the pinned tweet on the Twitter and then the bio on the Instagram as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, thank you so much. That was perfect. We'll do more of that. If you've got any subjects you'd like us to cover, because I think we've all got some stuff that we do quite enjoy. I've got this incredibly original TV series I started watching called The Expanse, which doesn't take from any films or TV series at all. That's while on that subject, someone put up something fucking perfect this week. A right wing nut job put something up, which is hilarious, which was that someone was asking for suggestions of non-woke TV series to watch. And then he goes, you've got to watch this. The Expanse is perfect. It's so anti-woke. There is literally a character in it who is a pansexual in a polygamous relationship who is played by a indigenous person and who is part of the social underbelly of the universe, and that's one of the better, more well-developed characters in this. It is one of the most woke TV series I've ever watched, and that's a good reason to watch it. So watch The Expanse as well, and Alien. Alien's
also just flipping awesome.
Yeah,
it doesn't. It doesn't really sound like my sort of cup of tea.
Fair enough, Tom. I understand. Yeah. There's nothing like it, really, to be honest with you. So, true.
Nothing like it.
With that, we're going to wrap this up. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. And thank you very much for letting me host, Tom, while you get to talk about Alien. I've loved every second. Love listening to it. And next week, maybe I won't be quite so tired as well. So. Thanks very much, everyone. And with that,
well, I mean, bye.
I was going to say cue the music. I was
there you go, you said it.
Doing that.